talk called Advancing Breeding in Plants Using Precision Genome Editing.
Thank you, Bob. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk about Cebus and the technology that we have. Well, I usually can't see these anyway, but I'll try. We'll talk about some things. What I'd like to do is give you a little bit of background. What is Cebus? Who is Cebus? Quickly talk about that, but then talk about what we call our RTDS, or Rapid Trait Development System, which is non-transgenic precision gene editing technology. Also, so the way that we're approaching it to improve our technology, and then talking about some commercial products that we have and we're actually selling on the marketplace right now. Cebus is a biotech technology company. We're privately owned at this point in time. We've got about 100 people, most of which are in San Diego. That's where our headquarters is. We also have a small office here in St. Paul and in Capella in the Netherlands. We're using this precision gene editing technology to improve plants. Now, we also have a sister company called Nucellus, who's focused on fermentation products, so yeast and bacterial and microorganisms, and we're using the same technology to allow them to make some value-added products for that are interesting in commerce. We basically are funded today through a combination of equity contributions and project partnerships, and some of our partners we have identified here: Flax Council of Canada, Rotam, which is a small chemistry company, and BASF. We all heard of them. And so we basically have partnerships that help fund the projects and target different crops and different things. Again, focusing on what we call non-transgenic breeding. If you take a look at over the years, there's been a huge and a continuing growth acceptance of biotech crops. That has a fairly significant increase over the number of years, a lot of acres and hectares. But if you look at it a little closely, you can see that of the total addressable market, which is 1.6 billion hectares, transgenic technologies have been accepted on basically 175 million. So there's a lot of opportunity there to provide traits that are looked at as non-transgenic. And so we're looking at that certainly as an opportunity. As we look back and say, how have we improved crops over the years? One starts with finding something and saying, yeah, I like to propagate that and use it and grow it. After that, we go into some classical breeding and development. We talked about mutagenesis before, marker-assisted breeding. Transgenics came along to say, hey, we could put some stuff in here that we didn't have before. And isn't that an interesting thing? Well, we also believe that now gene editing is sort of at the pinnacle of this. That allows us to do some things that BJ has already talked about, I'll talk about a little bit, that allows us to do things in a lot more targeted way and a lot more controlled way. So let's talk then about, as I said, our RTDS technology platform. Now, in some of the questions earlier, the bottom line is the whole area of genomics, right? As we have been learning more about structure and function of genes, now we understand more about our targets. If we put that together with a robust cell culture technology, we can use these gene editing tools, which allows us to make these targeted changes. Now, our Rapid Trait Development System, as we said, it's a non-transgenic gene conversion platform. We also have a letter from the USDA that says the same thing, that says, nope, this is not regulated, we can grow this, and using this technology. So we don't have any issues in the U.S. with regards to growing products from using our technology. It's very precise. The targeted base pair has changed. We don't leave behind any foreign DNA. We do introduce DNA to the cell, which you'll see momentarily, but nothing stays. And we take advantage of those natural DNA repair mechanisms that the cell has. It's also called in some areas oligonucleotide-directed mutagenesis, or ODM, and it can be successful and has been successfully applied to multiple organisms. Now, the basis of our technology is what we call our GRON, or gene repair oligonucleotide. This oligonucleotide is basically synthesized in the lab, and it's synthesized in a number of different ways, but we also, there's a couple things on here which we sort of point out. First of all, the ends are protected, and there's different ways that we do that, but the reason you want to do that is you want to not allow the DNA to be incorporated into the genome. What it does is it finds the gene target that we have made. Now, oh, I should point out too, that represents the change that we have that we're targeting in the target gene. Once this oligonucleotide finds the target region, it basically pairs there but forms a mismatch bubble. And that mismatch bubble then is recognized by the enzymes, the DNA repair enzymes, as a problem, has to fix it. And so the enzymes come around and essentially repair the DNA of the plant the way that our template would like it to be repaired. And so that occurs. The template is essentially destroyed. It's destroyed between 90 minutes and several hours. So it depends, but it doesn't have a whole lot of time that it takes to make the change. But in a situation like this, we can indeed find stable changes that are made at a certain defined rate. This has been done, as I said before, across a number of different species. We've basically had, Cebus has done some work in a number of these different species. And I'll talk about a couple of them just at the end. I'm going to be focusing more on our canola work. But also, as I mentioned, our Nucellus team working on yeast and other microorganisms using the same technology to create these very interesting and useful products. Herbicide-tolerant canola, I'll mention that later. That's really been our first product that's out there. But we also have, in the microorganism side, as we're working toward vitamin D and squalene from yeast, some very valuable products there that we are quite excited about. Patents certainly is an important part for any company, and so we've spent time developing patents around our technology, around the products, as much as we can to protect our technology and develop that as we go along. So what I want to talk about now is I talked in basic terms about how the Cebus technology works. We also are looking at other tools to try to improve the technology. One of the things that we have noticed over the years is that the probability or the frequency of the changes is very low. And, you know, we can certainly do 1 in 100,000, 1 in 10,000, but that still creates, it's still lower than what you'd like to see to be able to effectively develop products quickly. And so we've used Arabidopsis as our plant of choice in trying to improve our technology. And so what we've done is we've created a marker gene, which gives us a nice visual approach so we can follow these. We basically have developed a blue fluorescent protein, a BFP gene, which through our using our technology, what we call conversion, we create a green fluorescent protein, which you can very easily see in cells. Look at this a little bit closer. If we take a look at our BFP gene, we basically have the a base pair, base that we want to change. We add a converting gron, which has the targeted targeted base that we want to change there, and it does indeed convert it from blue to green and becomes a stable change in the plant. Nice thing, as I mentioned before, you can see the changes. So with Arabidopsis, it works very well. We've actually developed a similar system in canola, which helps us get a feel for the crop target plant, because what we can do in Arabidopsis sometimes doesn't always reflect what we can do successfully in the target species. And so we have both of these systems that are working, but Arabidopsis, we certainly have been successful at turning things around faster and moving through the system to answer questions very quickly. Now, as we have developed different treatments different treatments in the RTDS process, we have been successful at going from a fairly low frequency of conversion up to conversion, which is maybe 160 times better than what we started with. And I'll talk a little bit about a couple of these target approaches, what we've taken and what we've found to be successful in improving the efficacy of our technology. So if we got to start at the bottom, okay? So if we just look at using a gron versus just a mock situation where we'd add some DNA, but it wouldn't really do anything for a change. The GRONs do work by themselves. Okay? So if you just add those oligonucleotides to the cell, you can see changes. But then there are other tools out there, and we've talked a little bit about them. Got a little different picture, but it's the same thing that people have been talking about up to now. And so we looked at various tools in this toolbox of double-strand cutters. And when you do that, we've already talked about the different types of possibilities. You can disrupt, and you can basically knock out or insert. You can add a gene. You can add another gene that you can put a targeted transgene in. We'll focus more on the center area, which is a targeted gene change, or we call gene conversion. And so we first of all started taking a look at some of the glycopeptide antibiotics, and bleomycin were the families that we looked at. And these cleave DNA, but they're nonspecific. So they cut DNA in a number of different places. So if you take a look at this, you can see, well, okay, we can have breaks, but they'll be throughout the genome. And when that happens, we provide a template for the correction. You can see the correction and the gene, the changes that we are targeting. If we take a look at this, we can get a very significant change in our conversion by using the glycopeptides. So that it does work, it does improve things. The problem that it has is it creates other mutations throughout the genome, which you don't want. And so that creates a little bit of a challenge for us to be able to develop a commercial product without a lot of drag creating problems. So then we looked at newer tools than that. So we looked at TALENs also. And we asked the question, okay, can we get our gene correction if we add the GRON, and how will that affect the efficiency of our program? In this case, we can see that the TALEN, basically with the right and left borders here, cuts right near where we want to make the change, and we add the correcting GRON to that to the cells that with the TALENs, and then the conversion would take place. Now, the one thing I would remind you of is these GRONs that we create are basically set up and built so that they don't incorporate. So it's not just that we're seeing some crossovers and incorporation, but they're actually acting as a template to affect the changes. As we looked at the work with the TALENs, we also realized that there's quite a number of changes that would occur, insertions and deletions. And we expect to see quite a number of insertions and deletions. And sure enough, just as other work with TALENs went on, we definitely found that there are plenty of these events. And you can see that it basically shows quite a number, 20 or less, of the insertion deletions. Mostly you have deletions, but that can occur, and we do see that in our material. But when you add GRONs to this, so the oligonucleotide templates, then you also, as part of that mix, will have some corrected genes. In this case, the TALENs were quite useful to us to be able to give us a very significant increase in the conversion frequency. And so we can see that with a TALEN plus a GRON, you had a very significant 90 times better than if you had your baseline, which is no TALEN, no GRON. Just with GRON alone, you got it up to 3 to 4 times, but adding the double-strand breaker there right around the site was very important for us to be able to improve the technology and to be able to see some real efficiency changes in the program. So really, by the use of TALENs, and you could imagine other double-strand breakers doing the same thing, we can improve our base RTDS technology and have seen some improvements as we've gone forward. So as we've moved through the system, we have to ask ourselves, okay, well, we want to make a product of this. And so we have a defined process that we follow, starting with the gene, okay? We need to know what the target is. We need to be able to understand the mutations to make in that target gene. And then we work at sequencing and developing our GRON, to be able to target precisely what we want to change. All along, we have to obviously have a very robust cell culture methodology, because if you can't culture cells effectively and efficiently, you're not going to be successful. We go down to the protoplast level for every plant that we're working with. So that creates interesting challenges depending on the plant. Then we need to regenerate, and finally, either with our cell, our own program, or others, we transfer to various breeding partners. I mentioned the cell biology because it's a key part of our system. This shows how we have improved some of our canola work, where we had a fairly nicely defined process, got down to about 1,500 plantlets after 25 weeks. We were able to change a number of things in our culturing protocols to be able to improve this, to get down to the point of 24,000 in a 13-week period. So it was a much more efficient process that we were able to develop. And this is going on with all of the crops that we're working on. But you need to be able to do this to be able to develop traits quickly and efficiently. Our SU canola, sulfonylurea tolerant canola, is our first product to market. Here's our sales slide. They all don't work like this, but we sprayed the chemistry on the wild type, and you see it kills the wild type plant. If you make the converted change, we're able to have very healthy plants that resist the herbicide. And so we further developed that into our herbicide tolerant canola platform. Non-transgenic, it was launched this last summer. We actually had a pre-launch in 2014. This last year we had over 8,000 acres in the ground, and so we expect to have a lot more as we go on. And we continue to develop this trait Europe and other countries throughout the world. We have a very interesting situation here, because when I first started working with this trait and talking to breeding partners, they looked and said, I'm not too interested. We got our Roundup Ready, we're happy. We got our Liberty Link, we're happy with this. But we're finding that there's a very interesting demand, a fairly high demand for non-transgenic canola. And that demand continues to grow. And so we're taking advantage of that by developing a product that the market is really wanting. And fortunately for us, people have appreciated it too. So we've got some folks that took a look at the system. They like the SU system. They like the products that they're seeing. And these are just the first products. I think it's going to get a lot better as we go along. One of the other things that it works nicely in, if you think about soybeans, and we had some talk about soybeans earlier, soybeans keep moving north. And so there are a lot more soybeans going into Canada. You can't really grow a Roundup Ready soybean and Roundup Ready canola in rotation. Canola is a great weed in a soybean field. And so because of that, having alternatives provides the farmer a choice that they were able to use in the rotation. And so the SU canola fits nicely into that. One of the things that we have done is to also team up with this little guy here, Cargill. Cargill has basically said to us, yeah, we're interested in the non-GM oil canola market. And so they have been offering a contract to farmers that pays them a bit of a bonus to grow our hybrid. So it's been a very nice development to promote our product. It also doesn't hurt to have a company that's headquartered in San Diego, because if they buy enough bags of seed, a farmer gets a trip to San Diego. So that's sort of nice. And most of them from Canada, North Dakota, they sort of appreciate that in January or February. Now, we're continuing to work on improvement of our core RTDS technology. We are developing it in such a way that we need to get to the point of having the conversion events occur at a high enough frequency so that we are able to work without selection. With herbicides, I mean, we've worked a number of herbicides. You can select sometimes in culture. Well, as we look at some of these other traits, which I'll mention in a little bit, you can't select. And so you need to get your improvement of the efficiency. We're also looking at having multiple SNPs, and we've had some success making 6 changes under the sequence of a single GRON. So that means you could get maybe a little bit more precision in the type of trait, and not just a single SNP, but multiple SNPs when you have a more complex trait. And of course, if you have more than one locus involved, naturally that confounds things also. Some of the traits that we're looking at going forward, some of the disease resistance or some of the quality traits, have more than one target. So you want to be able to hit those, and if you do one at a time, it takes quite a while before you get to that point. We are working in other crops. And one of which is flax. We're targeting some glyphosate tolerance in flax, and we are having some very positive results in some plants in our greenhouse right now. So we expect to have this in the market by 2019. The only reason it's taken that long is flax does not increase all that well. So the seed you get from one plant, not many. So you need quite a number of generations to turn to get to that point. We're looking at rice, some herbicide tolerance traits in rice. Again, so this material is in our laboratory, and we have some very interesting results here. A couple targets that we're looking at here. We believe that this is going to add some significant value, not only in the U.S. rice market, which is very small, but throughout the world, which has some real demands, again, for herbicide tolerance in their system. And potato, we're looking at disease in potato, specifically Phytophthora. It's a very significant disease in potato. Costs a lot for a farmer to be spraying 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 times sometimes through a growing season. If we can provide the tolerance here, we should be able to add some real value at the farm gate. The other thing that that we're hoping at with respect to potato is that we can not only reduce the fungicide being used, but also look at some of these quality traits that you already heard BJ talk about. So I appreciate your attention and thank you. I hope that I was able to communicate some of what we're working on at CBIS. It's an exciting technology, and I think the whole area of gene editing is certainly going to be growing and developing over the years. Thank you very much.
Questions?
You mentioned sunflower in your opening slide. How are you guys doing the sunflower regeneration? I know that's sort of a key issue.
There was a picture of sunflower in our previous slides. We haven't got there yet.
Okay.
We haven't gotten there yet. And part of the reason is because of our business model. We actually find a partner that wants to maybe fund a project. Haven't been able to find a partner that says, yeah, sunflower is it. We're quite interested in that because we do believe we have some good ideas and good targets. But as you said, you know, we also realize that it would be a real challenge, particularly at the protoplast level. So we're not there yet. No, but there's a difference, though, because the previous speaker talked about segregating transgenes. We don't segregate out transgenes, so it's a purely natural, if you want to call it, event, and so that's not an issue at all. It's a good question, though, because we've had a lot of discussion with folks in Europe. We have 6 geographies that have said yes to our technology, but we're also waiting for the EU to come down with a legal ruling that says, what do we agree about with respect to these new technologies? Everybody we've talked to over there so far has agreed with us as to how they should be looking at technology. They're looking at it as mutagenesis. And You know, a previous question was asked about, you know, how you talk about your technology in a case. The way we talk about it is that any mutation that we make could happen in nature, given enough time, and if you looked hard enough. And so I think that's a message that I think is significant and does resonate.
Can I follow up that question?
Sure.
So this is my follow-up to that question. Actually, follow-up to both these questions, I think. So with your technology, can you work on species that don't regenerate from protoplasts?
The answer is yes, but today we have been successful in doing protoplasts in even some of those species that weren't. Flax is one of them. Flax, when we first started that project, the scientists in Canada said, you're not going to make it happen because flax, you can't take it to protoplast, it's not going to work. We have a very efficient protoplast system. So that is the point. Now, if you do it without protoplast, yeah, you can get there. The challenge is frequency, because you don't have as many cells that you're dealing with, maybe, that you would have the changes. So there's some significant step changes to get beyond that.
Any other questions? We got one here.
I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but I'll give it a try. During the early 80s, late 80s, early 90s, many of us were hoping that the original form of transgenic technology could help developing countries and some of the crops that they can grow alive that aren't particularly valuable, add value, add nutrition and other things to them. And that dream was dashed because the transgenes that were commercialized at first were easy to villainize. They were easy to demonize. And herbicide resistance was among them. And you all must have thought about that. You're kind of putting all your money in herbicide resistance, and that alone could turn public opinion against the technology for no other reason, and then we could lose this as well.
You start with herbicide resistance because it's easy to select within the lab.
Yes.
Okay, but at this point in time, as we have been increasing and improving the efficiency of the technology, we have been working on some. I talked about potato, where we're looking at disease resistance in potato, and that's sort of the first of many that are targeting the same way. We're looking at quality traits and nutrition-related traits, as you mentioned. So that's it. But you know, you start with what you can and what works, and so that's what we have.
And scientists know that, and farmers know that, but the public does not.
Right. No, that's true, and that is the challenge. I mean, unfortunately, when you start talking about herbicides, a question I was asked, well, why don't we just grow the crops without the herbicides? And he was standing in front of a field, fortunately, that I was with him at, and I could walk him into the field and say, that's the reason you don't grow without herbicides, because there were weeds everywhere in this field.
Maybe that's part of the answer, is more public education.
Yeah.
That was a good opportunity that you had.
No, it was fortunate. I was in the right place at the right time. But it is something that is a challenge. And part of it is just educating the populace and people that you're talking to say, no, this is agriculture. This is how things are done. You can even talk about the herbicides that are used today, not just herbicide-tolerant crops, just the conventional herbicides. You still have tolerant weeds coming out. Right, so that hasn't changed, and so it's simply a matter of how do you best make it fit into the system, and how do you best manage the problems that you run into. But it's a good point, though.
All right, maybe we could do it quick. Just last question before break, then.
How much these gene edits are stable from generation to generation?
They're completely heritable. There's no problem. They don't break down or anything. It's a change in the DNA that does not go away.
The plant accepts.
Plant is fine with it. Yeah. It would be like any other mutation that you'd find. So I mean, if you find a mutation that makes a red flower, for example, in a flower crop, it will be red from generation to generation. So that typically is the same thing with our technology.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Thank you.